The third case on the Southern Panel's oral argument calendar is Ginger McDonald, a special administrator of the estate of Robert E. McDonald II versus Katia Anderson. The case is number 60924 and 61622. Before we begin, I'd like to acknowledge the presence of students from the Las Vegas Day School. Welcome. We're pleased to have you with us here today. Is that your teacher here? Or yes, ma'am. Would you introduce yourself, please?
Carol Johnson.
Ms. Johnson, thank you for being here today and bringing your students and perhaps some of their parents with them. We appreciate that. Welcome. Are you ready to proceed, counsel?
Yes, sir.
All right.
Yes, Your Honor. Please the court, Cal Potter on behalf of Ginger McDonald and the estate of Robert McDonald. Knowing that the court is familiar with the facts of this case, I'd like to deal with the error in denying the motion for a new trial. Of course, the facts all center around the statement made by defense counsel at the time of the closing argument that all you need to do is simply sign the verdict form and the case is over. That does not mean that Mr. McDonald has not received compensation. It simply means that my client does not have to pay for that. And our argument essentially to the court is that based upon that statement, that the province of the jury was invaded, that the statement, one, was not a part of the trial record in terms of other compensation, but more importantly, that there was no evidence brought forward concerning other compensation. So as we look at the issue in the context of a fundamental right, it deals with the right to a jury, and the jury would not be told that no matter what they do, there's no harm done to the plaintiff because he will receive and has received compensation.
Mr. Potter, I apologize for interrupting your argument. And Ms. Clark, would you hold the clock? For the benefit of the students here, we are familiar with the facts, but they aren't. And I wondered if you could just take a moment and outline the facts of the case for their benefit so they might be able to put in context the arguments that you and Mr. Hansen are making.
Well, this is a case dealing with an automobile accident, Your Honor, where my client was rear-ended by Ms. Anderson. In the aftermath of that, he suffered a bruise or redness to his neck from the safety belt, and accordingly he then had what was believed to be an abscess. Based upon the facts that that is a very serious and emergent situation, meaning that they went to the emergency room to get the treatment, the determination was made that if in fact that is an abscess, that there was a need to have that removed for fear of either severe consequences, a sequela to the injury, or even death. And so based upon the emergent nature of the injury and perceived emergent nature of the injury, the doctors decided that they would try and remove that abscess. Consequently, they had difficulty intubating Mr. McDonald and putting the tracheal tube into his throat. As a result of that, the evidence showed that he had an epiglottis organ in his throat split and that he lost consciousness. The testimony from our expert in the case, Dr. Russo's, talked about the fact that he, in the difficulty of the intubation, he had to try and keep the airway open. He wasn't able to have the airway open and suffered brain damage from the loss of oxygen, as well as the fact that the epiglottis was split. That was a known complication in trying to save the man's life. So in terms of looking at what the aftermath was in this particular case, it's important to look at what the doctors were dealing with. They believed that it was an abscess in an emergency situation. Of course, there's testimony on the other side that he had cancer, which he ultimately did, and that a lot of his treatment afterwards was dealing with the cancer. But the fact remained that but for the fact of the accident, he would not have had the injury to his neck, and he wouldn't have had the need for emergent care. With that as a background to the...
We'll go ahead and start the time clock for the students' benefit. Each lawyer gets 15 minutes to argue their case, but I didn't want to take up Mr. Potter's time, and we'll invite Mr. Hansen to clarify any factual questions if he wishes to do so without being charged time, but we'll get into the argument now, if that's okay, Mr. Potter.
That's fine, Your Honor.
And we understand what you've previously said.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
And the concern is that with that backdrop, although there was working compensation treatment and that there had been bills that had been submitted and that there were references that we read in some of the depositions to workers' compensation, there clearly within the trial record was absolutely no evidence about any type of prior compensation. And based upon that, the court made a finding that, in fact, although unobjected to, that there were issues dealing with the motion and remedies. We had, during the course of the litigation, filed our, for the students here, motion and remedies being motions before the court hearing or the trial to help determine some of the evidentiary issues. And based upon that, it was our belief that, one, any award, and I submit to you, Your Honors, that there is no award that was given to Mr. McDonald, but in any event, it certainly wasn't in the trial record. So any reference outside of the trial record is a violation of the fundamental right to have the evidence presented to a jury through the judge's rulings and to have the determination made that indeed the jury was the one making the decisions pursuant to this case, not that some other tribunal had already made the determinations. We also rely upon the cases dealing with the collateral source and state that reference is once again a situation where there's an invasion as to the collateral source, and believe that the statements concerning any payments that were made pursuant to the statutory scheme of the workman's compensation is simply not what occurred in this particular case. The defense seems to argue that we should have asked pursuant to 616C215 for special instructions. But the concern here is not that the special instructions should have been asked. It's the issue that the jury has brought information outside of the trial record, and more importantly, that they're suddenly told that whatever they do, there's no harm, no foul, because, in fact, Mr. McDonald has already been compensated. And I would submit that there is no, once again, no evidence in the record, and that there are other reasons that exist in the record as to why the jury reached the verdict. It was not a unanimous verdict. Indeed, the jurors were in a situation where the defendants were not really contesting on ability, yet made no award. And I submit to you, based upon the fact that they didn't render an award to the plaintiff, is to show the magnitude of the statement that was made, that in fact some other compensation had already been granted. The remaining argument that I have dealing with the bankruptcy, opposing counsel has stated that it's not an issue unless it comes into a reversal. We agree. Our argument is essentially that it shouldn't have been decided by the court. It was really a post-trial type motion in any event, and that it did and had a practical effect of precluding any kind of settlement in this case. And although I know the court is not involved in settlements in that sense, it continued to have an impact on the ruling. It was certainly something that occurred prior to the case. The trustees that we looked at it did not impose any type of sanction, and I would submit that to the court and reserve my additional time.
Mr. President, before you sit down, was the reference to workman's comp the reference that would go toward payment?
I'm sorry?
Is the reference to workman's comp the only insinuation that there was some kind of payment?
It does, Your Honor. And it doesn't specifically say we receive compensation, but it simply means that my client doesn't have to pay for it. It doesn't say workman's compensation. The inference is that it is compensation. The only other compensation would have been workman's comp.
When a deposition was being read by one of the parties, that statement was made then.
The reference was why he had been there. It was actually two different statements. One was read by a law clerk, one for me, another by Mr. Hansen's law firm. They read statements in, and it dealt with why the individuals were coming to the particular doctors. And I submit that that's completely different from the fact that you have payments. We're talking about compensation here. And clearly the reference was as to whether, in fact, the compensation had been granted. And it simply was not a part of the record. It certainly couldn't be gleaned from the depositions. And it wasn't anything that I think reasonably that the jury should have known about. And so when we cite back to the cases and they try and bring up the statute dealing with, when I read the NRS dealing with workers' compensation, they're apples and oranges. Because you have a situation where we're talking about compensating the plaintiff, and it certainly didn't happen in the workers' comp. The only thing in the record is in the appeals record, because in the post-trial motions, about forward letters from Zurich and attached them as a part of the exhibits, but certainly there wasn't any compensation, and it allows the jury to say, well, it doesn't matter what we do here, somebody's already made the decision, don't have them a foul.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Potter. I notice, excuse me, Mr. Hansen, before you begin your argument, Judge Jacinto has come into the courtroom with a group of students. Judge, where are these young people from? Are they also from the Las Vegas State School? And is your teacher here?
No, we're parents.
Not just parents, you're parents. And we'd like to welcome all of you here today to observe the proceedings in the Supreme Court. Thank you for coming today. Okay, Judge, sure. Thank you. Not as a teacher, though, I suspect, Judge.
I won't touch that one.
Mr. Hansen, it won't be necessary for you to offer whatever corrections you thought are necessary to the factual descriptions by Mr. Potter. You can proceed with your argument however you wish to proceed.
Thank you. Well, I'll just quickly say that the biggest difference here, I'm Joel Hansen for the record, and may it please the Honorable Court. I've had Dean involved in the past, so I kind of like the friends, but that shouldn't make any difference here. Anyway, the one main difference that I have with Mr. Potter's recitation of the facts is that Mr. McDonald went in for a checkup right after he had the accident. That's on April 6th. And then he didn't go back to the hospital until April 17th. And that's when they found this red place on the side of his neck, inflamed. And so they started looking at that, and they said, oh, there's something wrong here. He's got either a hematoma or something in there, which is a pocket of blood. And so they started looking it out, and they decided they had to get in there and drain it out. And when they went in to drain it out, it was an abscess. It had all turned to pus. If it was a hematoma, it had been there so long that all the body's defenses had come and eaten up all the stuff and then left the bodies of the dead white corpuscles that came in there. So it couldn't have happened. In our view, that abscess could not have happened in that much time. It's 11 days. And so there are other things present there which were, we believe, were causing that. And we have testimony from Dr. Griffiths to that effect, that it could have been his dental. He had long-standing dental problems which could have caused an abscess. And he had cancer in his throat, which also could have contributed to or caused the abscess. So what we're saying is that the only possible part of the damages in the case would have been from the 6th to the 17th, or maybe a little bit into the hospitalization on the 17th. But once the doctors went in there to find out what was going on, they tried to intubate him to do the operation, they couldn't intubate him because he had this huge cancer in his throat. And so that's when the cancer treatment began. And most of his treatment after that was for cancer. And then I can say he had a lot of other problems that aren't really related here, but anything that would be possibly from the accident was actually caused by the cancer in his throat. So that's the clarification I want to make there. Now, first issue, they're arguing about the statement in closing. Now, the rule is that the statement in closing has to be so bad that it's only but for that statement the jury would have made a different verdict. And that just isn't the case here. The rule also says there has to be no other reasonable explanation. Well, the brief points out that there's lots of other reasonable explanations. And we put some of those forth. They were discussed in Mr. Hansen's, my son Jonathan's, closing argument without any objection. Here's some of the things that the jury could have believed, which would have made them rule the same way they did anyway. I forgot to say one thing. Mr. Potter, the appellant, did not put in any evidence of any medical bills before the 17th, even though there were some. And they probably could have found easily that they were related, but there wasn't anything put in there. If he had put something in, then they probably would have awarded something. But there was nothing to award because on the 17th is when the cancer treatment started. So to say that the verdict, they didn't get anything, the reason they didn't get anything is because they didn't prove any injury from the accident or any medical bills. They left that part out, and they started on the 17th. Now, they could have concluded that Mr. McDonald was not injured in the accident. They could have concluded that the hematoma or the abscess were not caused by the accident. They could have concluded that he was intubated in order to do a biopsy for the cancer, which is the case. The need for the tracheotomy, they could have believed that that was caused by the cancer, not by the need to drain the hematoma, and that his cancer was not aggravated by the accident, but that it's caused most of his problems and his disability, not the accident. And the jury could have believed that Mr. McDonald was trying to get the doctors to change their opinions, Mrs. McDonald was, because that was read in with some of the depositions. And I think Mr. McDonald wasn't believed because he and his wife were trying to blame all of their problems from April 17th on the accident. It's unbelievable if they would even try to do that. There's so much evidence of so many other problems, and mostly the cancer that he's being treated for, that it's just unbelievable that you would try to prove that. It's just not the case, and that all came out during the trial. Okay, I want to say just as an aside here that Judge Denton, even he believed that the plaintiffs had committed fraud in the bankruptcy court because they told the bankruptcy court, this accident gives us grounds to get out of bankruptcy or out of the bankruptcy court without paying because of hardship. But then they neglected to say that there was a case that they were going to bring that would have been an asset to the bankruptcy. So he decided that they had committed fraud, and that's why he did his bankruptcy ruling the way he did. Anyway, there's a lot of other things that the jury could have believed. There is a host of things that the jury could have made their decision on in this case. I don't have time to mention them all. But the rule is from the Ringel case, to warrant reversal on grounds of an attorney misconduct, the flavor of misconduct must sufficiently permeate the entire proceeding to provide a conviction that the jury was influenced by passion, prejudice, or prejudice in reaching its verdict. That's impossible. There's one little sentence here that they're trying to say that changed the whole thing. Now, Judge Denton didn't buy that. They brought their motion, and he said, maybe Mr. Hansen had violated the order, which is not true. He didn't, but I'll get to that in a minute. But even if he did, I find that didn't cause the jury verdict to be the way it was. There was lots of other things that were introduced into evidence that supported the verdict that they reached. And I've just told you about some of this. And so although the district court did rule that it was improper, he ruled that it was harmless error, basically. He didn't use those words, but that's what he ruled. Now, as far as Mr. Potter has argued that Mr. Hansen committed attorney misconduct, the stipulation, there was a motion in limine before the trial, and they said, okay, both of them said, we don't want anything in about workman's comp. So the judge said, fine, whatever you want, I'll grant it. But then during the trial, Mr. Potter was reading in some deposition, or a deposition, and there was stuff in there. He needed to get into that in order to prove his case. So he read in, or had read in, evidence of workman's compensation, that his client, Mr. McDonald, was trying to get workman's compensation. That happened a couple of times in front of those depositions. And Mr. Potter says, well, he didn't get any compensation. And this is before the court mentioned it's our appellate exhibit number 385. This is a letter from the insurance company that was managing the workman's comp stuff. And it says, and it's before you, we are accepting liability for your left-sided neck hematoma abscess only. So they accepted liability for that, which is more than we think they should have, but they did. Now, he's quoting the order that says that they didn't get anything, but that order says, and I have it here, that he wasn't disabled, and we're not going to give you any money for disability. But there's never anything except this letter that says, that doesn't say that he's not going to get anything. This does. He's going to get payment for the abscess and the or abscess / hematoma. So we don't think that Mr. Potter's wife accused Mr. Hansen of not telling the truth. Now the statement was, well, can you tell me how much time I have left?
5 minutes.
All right, I'm okay then. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
The statement Mr. Hansen made was a defense verdict didn't mean that Mr. McDonald hasn't received compensation. It simply means that the defendant doesn't have to pay for that. Now that doesn't say that he got compensation. If you look at it carefully, a defense verdict, I think it actually was said, but doesn't, a defense verdict doesn't mean that Mr. McDonald hasn't received compensation. It simply means that the defendant doesn't have to pay for that. Now that's a true statement because he didn't have to pay for it. She didn't have to pay for it. But he didn't tell them that he'd gotten compensation. He said, well, it doesn't mean that if he received compensation. That's what he was saying. And that doesn't say that he got compensation. Now, Mr. Potter has argued at length in his brief that this is prejudicial because the jury filed insurance. But now in his reply brief, he says, well, he admits that Mr. Hansen clarified that and said, no, I was only referring to the possibility of workman's compensation, if that. And so now he's not arguing that it was insurance. He's saying, it was workman's compensation. Well, if it was workman's compensation, He waived the judge's motion in limine order, and so did Mr. Hansen, and so workman's compensation was before the jury. There wasn't any disobedience of the judge's order at all, because they waived it away. And the judge didn't remember that when he made his ruling, but his ruling was still right because he said it was harmless error. Now, we cited some cases, this case Kramer versus Peavy, which you can, I'm sure you've looked at, but that was a very, very similar case, and the Supreme Court said that, well, we're not going to overturn it just because defense counsel made some statements about workman's compensation, because that was harmless error. And I believe that's what the case says, and that's why it was harmless error, if it was error at all. It was just one little part of this case. And as far as the bankruptcy part, quickly, I've explained that. But I got a motion before Judge Denton to dismiss their case for fraud in the bankruptcy court, saying that it was judicially estoppel, they were judicially estopped. Judge Denton said, I can't give that order. So he sent me over to the bankruptcy court. I went over there and they said, no, the bankruptcy court is, you have to give that order from Judge Denton. So then we did the research and it says, well, if the bankruptcy court determines that they can't do it, the state court can, because it's fraud on the court. You're telling them one court one thing and you're telling the other court the other thing. You can't play fast and loose with the rules that way. So Judge Denton entered his order saying, the first 100,000 or so of this verdict, if you get one, is not going to happen. You're not going to get that money. If you get 200,000, then you'll only get 100,000, because that's going to be subtracted. Mr. Potter did not do what he needed to do. He put the evidence of workman's compensation in. Then when it was mentioned, by stipulation, then when it was mentioned, he didn't, or that sentence was given, he didn't object. Now, if he had objected, the judge could have said, okay, and he could have done something to cure that if he thought it was an error. But Mr. Potter didn't object. Now we're going to retry the whole case because Mr. Potter decided not to object when he could have and should have. That's not right. I don't think we should just because of that. I think that's basically all we have. There were many other reasons that the jury could have decided its ruling on, and there wasn't any evidence of his injuries, medical bills just after the accident. The workman's compensation came in by stipulation, and the motion in limine order was waived, and the bankruptcy order regarding judicial estoppel was proper. Do you have any questions?
No, thank you. I don't think my colleagues do, Mr. Hansen. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge Hardesty, Justices Cherry and Justice Douglas. Appreciate your time.
Mr. Potter, you have approximately 7 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. In terms of the argument that's been made, it's really a cost-benefit analysis here. What is occurring here is they're making a determination whether they make the argument and whether they can get away with it. If it's objected to or if it's not, but the gamble here, as you can see, is the argument about the money. And I would submit to you, based upon the briefs that have been filed and the filings that were done before Judge Denton, it was intentional. It wasn't a situation where it was a slip of the word or fuzzy reasoning or some type of determination. It was a calculated argument that had been made previously by Mr. Hansen Sr. In another case.
It's not in this record, Mr. Hansen.
It is in the record before the court in terms of whether they made a determination of it was intentional or not. And I would submit to you that based upon that it wasn't.
Well, let me clarify something, Mr. Potter. I'm having difficulty with this argument, and that's why it's on for oral argument, partially, not just because of me, but my colleagues do too. My question is this. Under Kramer and under Tri-County versus Klinke, this court has said that the evidence concerning workers' compensation is admissible in a personal injury case
Now, the parties in this case may have agreed at the outset that there wouldn't be reference to workers' compensation, but that stipulation or agreement, whatever it was, that resulted in the court's in limine order is actually contrary to the law. It's contrary to Cramer, it's contrary to the exception in the workers' compensation statute, and it's contrary to Tri-County versus Klinke. The trial proceeds. There is a reference to workers' compensation. I'm having difficulty understanding that this is even error when the whole subject of workers' compensation could have been discussed in the trial legally and appropriately under the statute in both of those cases.
Because of the fact of what the comment is, Your Honor, if indeed that was correct, the parties didn't agree to that, and we limited it to the fact that there had been some statements about workers' comp by the doctors that they were referred to workers' compensation. The statement in question there goes outside of the workers' compensation. It tells the jury that you don't have to worry about what's been done because there's already been compensation. Counsel just stood up here and waved the letter from Zurich before you, but it wasn't in the record, Judge. It didn't go before the trial court. It's misconduct not only to argue it to the jury. I submit it's misconduct to bring it here in this courtroom. And those are the arguments that are in their brief. They're replete with showing something outside of the record. So it's a verbal wink and a nod to the jury that we have other evidence. Now, this court has held for many, many years that you don't argue outside of the record. The trial record does not support what Mr. Hansen just did. The appellate record that he relies upon is when they came back in and said, look, we had a basis to make this kind of argument, although that evidence didn't come in before the jury. We're allowed to go outside and make an argument outside of the evidence presented to the jury.
But do you agree with me, Mr. Potter, that if the defense in this case at the trial had said, wait a minute, under Tri-County and Cramer, evidence of workers' compensation payments are admissible in the trial, that the judge would have had to have allowed testimony of that?
Well, what the court did is made a determination that there wasn't any agreement on that. And the motions were filed on both sides and at that point in time. But the argument goes more than just to the compensation also. Counsel's trying to say, well, it's only limited to workman's comp. It's talking about insurance. I mean, the prior case dealt with the disability insurance. But in this particular action that's in question here, there's reference outside of the record, and that's the basis of a jury trial. That's the constitutional dimension of the error. If, in fact, you tell a jury, you don't have to worry about you, what you're going to do, because somebody else has already done it. I mean, this court has done this over and over in criminal cases, civil cases. You can't argue outside of the record. And so what he's trying to do is lessen the burden on the part of the jury. Yeah, maybe it's a sympathetic argument, maybe he's a sympathetic person, but here's the situation that you're faced with. You don't have to give him any money because he's already been compensated. And that isn't true. And all the cases you're signing to on workman's comp takes that into consideration and makes that type of determination. So whether we could ask for that instruction or not, we didn't ask for it. But that doesn't mean that they can come in and argue outside of the record. And that's the basis of our argument.
I'm concerned about the verdict form, though. I wish the verdict, there had been a special verdict form which talked about liability first and then a verdict form on the damages. Because I'm looking at the verdict form and it's strictly a verdict for the defendant. And it sounded like this was a cut and dry as far as liability on the part of the respondent.
Yes, sir. And although we haven't briefed the verdict form, I haven't looked at them since the time of the jury trial, but the concern is that they were taken outside of the province of what they were supposed to do.
Okay, I think any other questions? Anything further, Mr. Potter? You have 40 seconds remaining if you want to take advantage of it. Thank you, Mr. Potter. Thank you, Mr. Hansen. And Mr. Hansen, for your briefs and your argument today, we appreciate the input. The case will stand submitted. Nice to see all of you again. Thank you.
Pleasure seeing you, John.